fries. Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. All persons having any business before this honorable Supreme Court of the State of Hawaii, draw nigh. Give your attention and you shall be heard. Please be seated.
Case number SCWC 29131. State people arguing for the petitioner, Peter Van Name Eschick, arguing for the respondent.
Morning, counsel. And first, let me just say the court is honored to be here this morning at the William S. Richardson School of Law. Counsel, you're ready to proceed, both of you. One thing I just want to let you know that the court is familiar with the juror numbers. So if you want to refer to the jurors who are issued here by number, that's fine. We know and we're aware of what the numbers are for each of the jurors. If you want to refer to them in that manner, that's acceptable to us. And my understanding, Professor, you reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal, so we'll give you a warning at that point. Mr. Fudo will give you a warning of 10 minutes to go on your argument. Please proceed, Mr. Fudo.
Thank you. Before I begin, I'd like to make a brief comment about a colleague who is also a friend of Justice Gowdy. He was in front of this panel, Capital Bay, in January, and has done probably 50 or 100 appeals in front of this court. His name's Robert Harris. He was diagnosed with pancreatic cancer last week, and he's at Queens fighting for his life. So I'm dedicating this argument to him. this is a
thank you. And Mr. Esser, I know he's in all of our thoughts and prayers as well. And
thank you.
I think it's very appropriate that you did. That you recognize him in the panic, just did.
This is a fairly simple case. And by the way, Your Honor, I don't remember the names of the numbers of the jury, so I'm glad you do. I'll try and refer to them generally and hope that you know what I'm talking about. I sort of refer to them to the two before and the two after. This is an interesting case because there's basically two problems with what occurred below. Challenges for cause that were turned down that were pretty obvious that should have been granted, which is sort of a cocky type approach to peremptories. And then two that were granted afterwards, which is a procedural error. In other words, the first two, counsel had to use peremptories to remove, and it was a curative thing. There was no problem with the procedure. He just simply had to cure the failure to discharge those two jurors. And the second two is a problem with procedure. Procedure in terms of peremptories, which comes from 24D HR Penal Procedure Rules and 17F Circuit Court Rules. It's not in the statute, but it's definitely in those rules. The statutes are 635, 29, 30, as this court knows. What the problem with this procedure below, which is basis of the dissent by Judge Ginosa, is that there are two ICA cases, one of which was written by Justice Koba, and the other which was written by Chief Judge Burns back in the 90s. And those two cases were just clearly violated in this case by the, not so much by the curative situation with the first two jurors, but the procedural issue with the second two. And in fact, it's even a worse violation than the Carvalho and Timas cases, because in those cases, it was only one juror that was considered for cause afterwards. In this case, it was two. So what I'd like this court to focus on, and interestingly enough, this is language in the response by the state. If you look at Iuli, which essentially the ICA says that in Iuli, this court, an opinion written by Justice Moon, backed off of the Carvalho approach and didn't go plain error and essentially said it has to be raised below. Of course, the Iuli case, though, was a curing case. It was a curative case. It was the situation like we had for the first two jurors, where there was a motion for cause that was overruled and the attorney had to, quote, cure, again, like the Kauai case as well. And the Oberlin Court said, no, this isn't plain error, and you should have raised it below, or at least indicated displeasure with
Mr. Esser, if I might interrupt you, I'd like to go back to point one before you get to point two. I don't mean to throw you off your train of thought, but I'd like to talk about jurors 19 and 23A, who themselves were victims of child sexual abuse. But the ICA majority seemed to be pretty clear that they thought that the defense had waived any objection to this curative problem, and that defense counsel passed the jury panel for cause and did not say that there were some other jurors that they would have preferred to use their peremptory challenges on, and therefore it's too late to make an objection. What is your response to that argument?
Well, to me, that has nothing. It's an irrelevant observation, because passing for cause and picking members off the jury that a party doesn't like are completely different concepts. There was no passing for cause issue in the Kahi case. The only question we have here in terms of that is whether or not you're going to require a party, in order to do a reversal on appeal, to make an objection below and to the jury, as happened in Kahi. That's how this court distinguished Carvalho and Timas in the Oberlin case. What I'm arguing, Your Honor, and I understand.
Mr. Esser,
we don't have those.
Mr. Objections. Esser, excuse me. Didn't the petitioner or the defendant object to 19A and 23A?
Oh, yes.
Challenge them for cause.
Yes.
So that, and that challenge was denied.
That's correct.
So that the passing for cause of the panel excluded those objections, the court said. Other than what you said on the record, you passed for cause.
I believe what Justice Duffy's referring to, Your Honor, is the 12 jurors that ultimately served on the jury were passed for cause. I think that's what he's referring to. And of course, by that time, those two jurors had been removed by peremptories.
When was the procedurally, wasn't the challenge for cause after the court's general voir dire?
Well, there's two of them. But if we focus on the two that were former child abuse victims, that was before the peremptories were exercised. The other two that were removed because of English.
Wasn't it after the court's general voir dire, but after the defense?
It was after the general voir dire.
And after the defense voir dire, according to the state, the defense counsel actually passed the panel after the defense voir dire. Is that not correct?
No. The defense attorney attempted to ask questions and was cut off. Now, one of the problems
So you're saying that after the defense counsel finished his voir dire and he renewed his objections as to cause as to those two jurors?
I don't know that he renewed it. He made it at that time. After he learned during the voir dire that these two people were child abuse victims, at that time he objected. In fact, it was sort of a sua sponte thing. The court said, well, it sounds like these people want to move on, so we'll just let them stay on the jury. Any problems with that counsel? And that's when defense counsel said, big problems. This is exactly what charges me today. It was a straightforward cause situation. The only difference that's a little strange is there were no questions by the prosecutor. There were no questions by the court into the details of what they had experienced. And they cut off defense counsel's voir dire. But in saying that, as this court is aware, we have an incomplete record. That there was a big problem with the recording devices in the courtroom.
Clear the court did deny a challenge for cause.
I think that we have a bigger problem with a second juror, because we don't see with a second juror how much they cut off defense counsel's review. But we do see it clearly with the first juror.
Mr. Van Esser, considering that questioning was truncated by the court.
Yes.
So you're not going so far. Say a woman is a victim of sex assault, completely a victim. You're not asking the court to say, as a matter of law, a trial judge should not believe that woman when she says she can be fair and impartial.
Absolutely. That's Bikini. That's Bikini and another case I cited in my brief. I mean, no, not so much that it's per se, but that the judge has an obligation to question.
Of course. And it's because it's an incomplete record. But not as a, but you're not saying as, or the, not an incomplete record, but the court stopped the questioning.
Yes.
But you're not asking the court to hold as a matter of law any victim of sex abuse cannot be a fair and impartial juror.
It's a good question, but you have to divide that to two jurors. The first juror, at the age, happening at the age of 14, matter of law. That's LaRue, I think that's the name of the case, which is cited by the ICA. To me, that's just clear. That's like having Mike McKeeley on the jury. No, forget it. You don't have to ask any questions. The second one, it isn't clear from the record if it was a child abuse situation. All it says is sex abuse or something like that. So arguably, how old were you? Some of the things. It could have been an improper touching or something. I still think it probably would have gone under LaRue. But the first one, yeah, as a matter of law, that's what LaRue said. No questions asked. And in a sense, the judge didn't fail to voir dire because she didn't need to. When she heard that on the first jury, it was done. I really want to get to the second argument.
LaRue was a case in which the fact of the abuse came out during jury deliberations.
That's correct.
Is that a distinction that might affect how we would view or how we would apply the rule in the context of questioning during voir dire?
I think the only thing you should know, LaRue, is that it was plain error. That when it came out, there was no objection. In other words, the trial lawyer didn't say, whoops, I want a new trial because of what happened way back in jury selection. It was actually plain error in that case as well.
Well, on the application, no one disputes that 19 and 23A should have been disqualified.
That's correct. Although I get the sense in the answering brief, they objected.
In the answer, but I'm talking about on application. That would be your application and the response to your application.
You know, I was unclear because the prosecutor seemed to focus on those two jurors and, by the way, ignore the dissent, which I couldn't understand. The prosecutor is one of the best appellate lawyers in Honolulu, so. But I was very surprised when he didn't focus on Gnosis' dissent in those second two jurors. He focused on the first two, and I think there's some question. I think he goes to the constitutional issue, Your Honor. Why would he discuss whether it's a constitutional question without essentially challenging the cause rulings?
But assuming that he didn't challenge on the application,
yes,
whether or not the court abused its discretion as to the two sexual abuse people, no one has raised a constitutional question in the application. In your application.
That's right. That's what I said in my response, and that's also what you say in Carvel. I mean, there's a very good explanation, and I don't mean to flatter you, Your Honor, but that's a great discussion of peremptories in a Carvel case. I mean, it very clearly says that this is very important, even though it's not constitutional. So this whole discussion of, oh, it's not constitutional is sort of off the mark. The whole point is that this goes back to common law. This is a 1903 law in Hawaii, 635, 29, and 30. And if you don't comply with that procedure, it's plain error. And I think it's clear, no one's asked me this yet, but I think it's clear that there's a violation of Carvalho and Timas in this case. To me, the only question is whether or not this court's going to uphold those two cases. Because if anything, it's a worse problem. I'm talking about the second two jurors. It's a worse problem in this case because there were two that were challenged for cause and removal.
Mr. Esser, moving on to that issue, do you assert that the court abused its discretion in excusing those two jurors after its supplemental questioning of them? I mean, the fact that the court, first of all, did the court err in resuming questioning of them after the peremptory challenges? And secondly, based on the record, do you believe the court abused its discretion at that point in excusing?
I don't think it's an abuse of discretion. I think it's plain error. There is a procedure in 24D and 17F. It's absolutely clear. And what Carvalho and Timas say is that if the procedure is not followed, it's plain error.
Okay, well, let me ask you this. So if something came to the court's attention after the peremptory challenges have been exercised, after the peremptory challenges have been exercised, that causes it to have concern about a juror, but before the alternates have been seated, is your position the court should just sit silent, or is there something it can or should do?
No, and I point that out in my cert petition. If there's a sleeping juror, which I've had lots of sleeping juror cases, and that happens like a week or two later, and that juror can't go on because they've slept during the evidence, then obviously the court voir dires and brings it up and dismisses that juror. At that time, arguably, there should be a request for a peremptory, but if the alternate replaces, which usually happens, then and there's already been a peremptory that purchases the alternate, there's no problem. This case is a different fact pattern. This isn't that hypothetical. This is a motion to remove two jurors that was
I'm saying when the alternate hasn't been seated yet. So after the peremptory challenges have been used, but before the alternates have been picked.
Or even selected, right?
Have even been selected. Yeah. If the court observes something, your position is the court can act or should not act.
No, the court didn't observe something. What the court did was allow the prosecutor
to renew. Please answer my question first.
Sorry. If let's assume one of the jurors faints or says, by the way, Your Honor, I have Hodgkin's disease, whatever.
That's inappropriate.
You get a point.
Okay. At that point, the court should do something.
Well, if something is raised that could not have been raised prior, then arguably the court should do something. But at that point, I would say that the court is also under the obligation under 24D and 17F to allow additional peremptories. Because if you exercise only one peremptory, Your Honor, with 10 jurors, that's what happened. The other two weren't there. That means you're not doing a balancing of all 12 jurors. That's exactly what was discussed by Justice Acoba in Carvalho. It's just not the procedure. It's an errant procedure.
And why the defense counsel here didn't ask for that, though, correct? Didn't ask for more peremptories.
That's why we're here, is to argue whether it's plain error. But I would say this. He did not object to those two jurors prior. And I argued in my reply that the reason the court didn't say, by the way, you have any problem with these jurors is because he had already said no. Now, there's two objections.
Well, I thought he had challenged them previously. No, that's incorrect.
He did not. The state challenged them. Okay?
Initially?
Yes, that's the whole point.
I thought the defense counsel challenged them.
No. We're talking now about the ones that could speak English, okay?
Yes.
And the state, the prosecutor.
They didn't say he couldn't speak English.
You
know, one, it's arguable that these two jurors could not serve.
It certainly is arguable.
Yeah, and so it would be difficult to say it was an abuse of discretion if the court left those two jurors on.
Absolutely.
One, the first one was a foreman for 36 people at some bakery, and he said he could understand everything. Maybe he had problems speaking.
Leonard's Bakery, Your Honor.
The second, thank you. The second person said, He couldn't hear very well, and he had a hearing aid. But if people spoke into the mic, then he could hear. So the court could very well have kept those two jurors on without it being an abuse of discretion. But going a little further, what happened here was the court changed the procedure set out under the statute and under the rule.
Absolutely.
Because after all the peremptories were exercised, it entertained a challenge for cause that should have only been entertained before the exercise of the peremptories. So then, because the court changed the procedure, shouldn't it be the burden of the court then to determine how to treat the parties equally when it already had changed the procedure, a procedure not set out in the statute or in the rule?
I agree, except if you look at Carvalho and Timas, basically the judge didn't know. The judge just changed it because they thought that'd be a better idea to choose alternates in those two cases.
But under the Chief Justice hypothetical, where an issue comes up,
yes,
after all the peremptories have arisen, then and the court has to do something, isn't the burden on the court to determine what should be done? I mean, it doesn't fall to the parties, because all the statute and the rule says is the parties are entitled to three peremptories. It doesn't say what happens if the court changes the procedure.
I agree. But the whole doctrine of plain error is that we don't focus on what the lawyer should have done. What we focused on whether his defendant got a fair trial. And in Carvalho and Timas, it said, if you don't follow the procedure under 24D and 17F, it's plain error. And Iommi did nothing to change those rulings. Now, I want to distinguish between the two groups of jurors. I call the first one a curative peremptories. I call the second one procedural errors. The first one is Iommi on its facts. The only difference is in Iommi, there was only one juror that should have been excused, and it was a much more iffy situation. It was some guy saying, I'm not sure I can be unbiased. as opposed to an obvious situation we had two. But assuming that they're the same, there's a distinct difference. And what the ICA did was focus on Iuli and what happened on Iuli in terms of distinguishing the Kahi case, two decisions by Chief Justice Moon, and said, you got the defense attorney has to object below, and therefore it's, well, it didn't say it's not plain error, but it didn't address plain error. That's why I think it's important to look at the response, the state's response. The Iuli case was based on Martinez Salazar, which of course is not mentioned in Carvalho or came down after Carvalho, but those cases, that line of cases that Martinez Salazar dealt with, and it's all curative. It's people using peremptories to fix challenge rulings that are wrong. And this is what, this is quoted on page 9 of the, Martinez Salazar, page 9 of the response. In choosing to remove Gilbert, in our case, the first two jurors that were sex abusers, rather than taking the chance of appeal, Martinez Salazar did not lose a peremptory challenge. That's exactly what the ICA sort of ruled. If you want to use peremptories to fix what the judge screwed up on, that's not losing peremptories. You got your peremptory challenges. Now, this next sentence is very important. Rather, he used the challenge in line with the principal reason for peremptories, to help secure constitutional guarantee of a trial by an impartial jury. The issue is that Martinez Salazar and Iuli focus on fixing problems. And Carvalho and Timas, let me read you the language from those two cases. Carvalho at page 171, this is what Justice Scalia says, the procedure used by the court was clearly incorrect. You can't make that observation in Iuli, because the procedure was correct for peremptories.
But may I ask you a question, Mr. Van Esser? The procedure is one dictated by statute or rule, not by the Constitution. Typically, aren't our plain error cases relate to fundamental constitutional rights? Is that a possible distinction, or how would you rebut that argument?
That's easy. All you have to do is look at the front of Iuli. It quotes Carvalho, and of course, Justice Acoba was one of the five votes for Iuli. Not very much, whether he would have gone along with it, he thought they were changing Carvalho, not because he's stubborn, but because it's a great ruling. And they quote Carvalho, and they quote the part that essentially says, yes, this isn't a constitutional right, but it's very important, it's based on common law. One of the most important rights ever due and accused is the language. It's from a U.S. Supreme Court case, Poynter versus United States. So that, as far as I'm concerned, equals plain error.
That was a holding, or that was an observation in dicta?
In Iuli, they quote, Kahi quotes that language, Timas quotes it, Carvalho quotes it. That's the law in Hawaii, that it's a very important right. And the right is not mixed up with its curative use of it. Because in that case, when you use peremptories to cure, you're actually doing partly what peremptories are supposed to be used for. But when you have a procedure where they're exercising peremptories on less than all of the jurors, in our case 10, then it's and I'll quote the same thing from Timas. This is what Chief Judge Burns said. Trial court's procedure does not conform to the procedure we adopted in Carvalho. Those are procedure cases. And both those cases were reviewed.
Well, ultimately, isn't the problem.
Certiorari, by the way, by this court.
Ultimately, isn't the problem that in this case, in effect, the prosecution got more so called peremptories than the defendant? Because the prosecution used up three peremptories, and after all the peremptories were used up, renewed its motion to exclude, 19 and 23, I'm sorry, 43 and 8. Okay. And so in doing that, it in effect got to exclude jurors after everyone had exercised their allotted peremptories and after the jury had been passed for cause.
That's what I argue in my brief. They got five, we got one. It isn't close. We got one peremptory because we had to use them to get rid of two that should have been excluded. And then those two jurors that were removed, I would argue that was just two more peremptories by the state. That's the way I characterize it. That's five.
That comes back to my first question. You believe they should or should not have been removed by the court for cause?
Oh, not for cause.
No.
But I would say this, it's a close call, and it's abuse of discretion. So I'm observing that as an appellate lawyer, not as whether or not the judge should. As an appellate lawyer, I wouldn't have raised that issue on appeal. I didn't. It wasn't in my opening brief. The issue is whether or not
the question is who would fix that problem, or whose obligation would it be to fix that problem? The court went outside of the procedure, allowed a challenge for cause after everyone had exercised their peremptories. So who should be responsible for fixing that problem?
Well, you know, and I think that it's plain error, which means the judge should have. But I also think the judge should not have allowed the minute that the prosecutor said, I want to renew my request for cause, the judge should have said, sorry, the peremptories are over and I already ruled.
Okay, isn't that an abuse of discretion? Not to allow the particular jurors to be, or not to keep them or exclude them from the panel, but to allow a renewal after the peremptory as a procedural matter, was that an abuse of discretion to allow the motion?
Well, the only reason I keep saying plain error is because of Demas and Carvalho. And because if the judge allows a renewed objection, the judge
outside
is
the rules.
Outside the rule.
So couldn't that be an abuse of discretion?
I'm of course like the right wrong standard review, but I see where you're going.
Well, you know, Mr. Ching decided not to say anything after the renewed motion and the granting of the motion. There was an election on the part of defense counsel not to ask for. And I understand what Justice Acoba is getting at. You know, the court has a primary responsibility, but couldn't that be trial tactics? He was satisfied with the jury, even if he had, you know, if he had wanted to kick out two more, he would have said something. So it's a little difficult to reward that.
I would agree with you if there wasn't Carvalho and Timas. In Timas, Your Honor, not only was there no objection below, it wasn't in the points. It wasn't raised in the appeal. Judge Byrne said, sua sponte, by the way, there's a violation of the Carvalho procedure.
Counsel, I have a question following up on the Chief Justice's hypothetical. Sometimes in trials, after all the voir dire is concluded, a juror will suddenly raise his or her hand and say, Your Honor, may I approach the bench? And they come up. Let's say in this case, where, not in this case, but in a trial, in a sexual assault trial of a minor, let's say that everyone had been passed, all the peremptories had been exercised. A male juror raises his hand, says, may I approach? Says, you know, you asked that question, but I want you to know now, I'm going to tell you now that I was accused of sexually molesting my granddaughter, and I was found not guilty, but I think I could be fair. And then at that time, the state challenges that juror for cause. What is the trial judge to do? Are you saying that there can be no challenges for cause after all of the peremptories are exercised?
I think that Justice Koba provides the remedy. What he's suggesting is that it's up to the trial judge to fix it if there's a problem like that. And he would fix it by allowing
sua sponte, saying,
yeah,
defense, you have an additional peremptory.
I'd also argue, by the way, in that case, it would not only be a problem exclusion, it would also be a problem with lying to the court, because you know, in a case like that, the first thing the judge is going to say is there anybody in here who's ever had been charged or had any problem with this issue?
The reason you would have to allow additional peremptories, although the U.S. Supreme Court has said in the past that the trial judge should start the whole veneer process or jury selection process all over again if that happens, but one way to remedy it would obviously be to give the defendant the number of peremptories equal to the number of jurors who would be excused because of a late disclosal.
And one of the problems that wouldn't cure is the exercise of the first three, because those three were exercised against.
Yeah, but it would cure the problem. It would cure the problem that you complain of, that there is a disparity in
the
number of in effect, peremptory challenges given. By giving two additional peremptories, because the court went along with the prosecution and excluded these two additional jurors, the court would then reinstate parity as between the defense and the prosecution in terms of many attempts they had to exclude
and
the
jurors. And you focus on that in Carvalho, but you also focus, Your Honor, in Carvalho, on the importance of exercising peremptories with all the people they're subject to them. If you only have 10 out of the 12 jurors when you exercise your one peremptory, then it's not the procedure. So I don't think you can fix it. I think that if the Supreme Court's saying you should start over, that's what you should do.
Well,
but
that's what the Supreme Court said at one time.
We
didn't say that later.
I understand that. We have a very simple situation in this case. We have Carvalho and Timas times two. And we also have two jurors that were excluded on precisely the same grounds 2 seconds after the peremptory is finished. What we got is the prosecutor having five peremptories. That's the way I look at this case. I don't think we need to go into what does the judge do if somebody says, I'm a Nazi, whatever.
Can we leave this verdict in place knowing that, in effect, the prosecution, by reinstating its motion to exclude, in effect, got to exclude five people from the jury, whereas the prosecution got to exclude three people?
You may go ahead and answer.
Obviously, I don't think so. And I would say this. Not only do we have Timas and Carvalho, we have Cahi and Timas and Carvalho. We have four jurors here that cause problems. We don't just have a failure to file the procedure. We have an overwhelming problem with this peremptory process. Even though, arguably, if we just had the situation in front of this court today without those two post-peremptory jurors, you could arguably apply Iuli and say, overrule, whatever, affirm. But when you put them all together, which is that's my only problem with Judge Ginoza. She focused just on those last two. To me, you got to put it all together. You got to take those two and also consider the fact that out of the three he had, he only got to exercise one, really. And that's the 5-1 thing. This isn't a 3-2 thing. This is a 5-1 thing because of those jurors. I used up the time.
Thank you very much, Mr. Esser. Mr. Fudo?
Good morning. Don Fu representing the state in this matter. Typically, I'm tasked to present cases the facts of which would bring tears to people with the coldest of hearts, and as such involve defendants who have committed acts that are of profound importance to the public. Therefore, any notion of plain error should be seriously and critically examined. This case is no different and deals with society's interest to protect our daughter children from sexual predators, especially when the predator is a family member, in this case, her father. Due to the heinous nature of this offense and the precedent in this jurisdiction regarding peremptory challenges, this court can reasonably presume that counsel, who have been barred since 1982 and is the named partner in his own law firm, would have alerted the court to any irregularities in the selection of the jury that might have affected his defendant's right to have the case tried before a fair and impartial jury.
If I might interrupt you, Mr. Fudo, I'd like to discuss for a moment the whole concept and purpose of peremptory challenges. I, like you, had the opportunity to try cases, and me, for some 35 years, having a mentor at Wally Fujama, and the reason I bring that up is that he always pointed out to me that the process of jury selection is one of non-selection. You have the 12 people who are called to fill the box by the court clerk. You deal with those on the issues of challenges potentially for cause, and it's a court decision as to whether anyone gets removed for bias or prejudice that might interfere with their right for any party to a fair and impartial trial. And after that's done, then you get to the concept of peremptory challenges, which this court has held as a fundamental part of the defendant's right. And that challenge is one for the lawyers and for the parties. to look at what they have in the box and look behind them in the room, or in this case, behind you, Mr. Fudor, and see whether you can improve your position on the jury panel with the people behind. But in order to make that informed judgment as to whether you can improve your position, you have to know that the 12 people have already been passed for cause. There's no other way to do it. And then you make your judgment as to whether the ones in the box don't like me, the trial lawyer, my client, the type of case I'm trying, or I think there's somebody better suited in the back of the room. Here, the defense attorney, Mr. Ching, never had that opportunity with respect to the last two jurors. By the time they were in panel, he didn't have any peremptory challenges. So doesn't that subvert the whole process of a peremptory challenge for the parties and their lawyers?
That's a very interesting question. And I think you, having done trials, and myself having done trials, and many of the justices here, I'm sure, having tried cases, knows that challenges for cause always can occur after preempts. If you'll indulge me for just a moment, here's the 12 in the box in this particular case. They were passed for cause before the preemptory started. Prosecutor and Mr. Ching passed them for cause. Now, when it gets to the point that Mr. Ching has his last preempt, he wants to excuse this lady in the first row there. He excuses her. This is the first time now a juror from the array will replace her. Importantly, that would be the first time he can interview that judge, question that person, and exercise his for cause challenge. So this notion that for cause challenges must occur before the preemptories is fundamentally and profoundly incorrect.
Well, Mr. Fudo, in this particular instance, there wasn't any additional information that came after the panel was passed for cause. Right? The court reconsidered the motion, or heard the renewed motion, I should say, and granted it based on information that was available to the court before the panel was passed for cause. So isn't that a fundamental difference between putting somebody in or somebody coming out afterwards, a juror coming afterwards and saying, oh, I want to tell you something I didn't tell you before?
You know, it would, Your Honor, if that's what happened. See, that's not what happened.
In this case?
No, yeah, that's not what happened. After the array came, 61, 12 in the box. All counsel passed the array for cause. Then it was during the prosecutor's individual voir dire that this issue with the proficiency of English came up, and at the end of her voir dire, she requested they be excused for cause. At that time, the judge said provisionally, at this juncture, I see no red flags. So it was denied, passed for cause. Now it was on defendant's voir dire where he continued to question Yase and Denzel, thereby providing new information and facts which supported the prosecutor's renewal for cause. This court, it seems like the ordering of things is really not clearly established.
Why didn't the prosecutor raise that before the peremptory challenges? Why didn't she raise that issue at the close of the voir dire by defense counsel? Why did she wait?
I have no idea why she waited.
If there's no explanation in the record, shouldn't there be a consequence for her having waited until after the peremptories?
A consequence for what? Renewing a motion? Anybody that's done trial knows that you can always renew a request before the judge. That's just fundamental trial law. You can always ask the judge to reconsider a prior ruling.
Right, but you do it at times when there are appropriate actions can be taken and the consequences of the grant or denial of the motion can be limited. In this case, by waiting until after the peremptory challenges had been utilized, in effect, didn't she deny the defense the opportunity to make the decision whether to use the peremptories on these jurors or not?
Of course not. You don't have anything in a silent record which this court in Huang said, you will not presume error. Huang, that would be 93 Hawaii 333. You're not going to presume error from a silent record. And more importantly, you don't have a silent record. You have a defense counsel that was fully engaged in the jury selection process, did not object to the principle of renewing a motion for cause, did not object to the procedure where the court re-questioned the jurors, and further information came out that one said he didn't understand, couldn't understand some things, that was his say, and it came out with Denzel. He just couldn't hear. So then when the court made the decision after getting more information from both people, defense counsel doesn't object.
So in your view, unlimited discretion of the court to reopen voir dire after the...
The court did not reopen the voir dire. New information was brought evidently to the deputy prosecutor's attention.
There's nothing in the record to indicate there was any new information other than the deputy prosecutor chose to come forward and renew the motion. Isn't that correct?
No, see, that's not correct. After the deputy prosecutor finished her voir dire of Yase and Denzel, there was information that the deputy prosecutor believed English proficiency was a problem. At that time, the motion was denied. Now counsel has his opportunity to voir dire. He brings more information out in his questioning, which shows that they don't understand, it could be a problem with English. Now, then he passes for cause.
And why at that point didn't she say something?
I don't know why she didn't, but the point is, there's no rule that says she must. More importantly, since counsel are the litigators and they're protecting the interests, especially in a case like this with their clients, the question should be, if counsel thought it was improper and failed, why didn't he say it? More so when you consider this. At the beginning of jury selection...
And Mr. Fudo, when you go away from the mic too much, we're not going to be picking up for our audio. Just be aware of that.
If you... I don't think you... Just one moment. Respectfully, Justice Steffi, I understand what your purpose was when you were selecting juries. Listen to what this defense counsel said his purpose was. Our main goal, both the state and defense, is to make sure we get as much as possible an impartial and fair jury to both sides. And I think that's fair. It's not an exact science. We could spend hours, days, and perhaps forever trying to get the jury. A counsel this engaged and this in tune with the fairness of it, you have got to believe, you have got to expect counsel, if they believe there is an irregularity, to say something to the court. The court would have had the power at that time to award, as Justice Acoba seems to suggest, additional preemptories. And more so because this case was tried in 2008. By 2008, the settled law in this jurisdiction made very clear that if you don't speak up, if you don't inform the court that there is some problem, then be forewarned that on appeal, you will not have been able to sustain your burden that there was an impairment or denial. The cases I'm referring to are both civil and criminal. Civilly, I believe it was Justice Nakayama in 1997, Kawamata. I believe also in 1997, Justice Nakayama authored Kauhi. So they say what happens when you preserve your error. And it's not, as I heard said, actually preserving. It's just you are now making a record to show there was an denied or impaired by informing the court. I had to use this peremptory. I want another one. That is who I would have struck. In Iuli, which is a 2003 case, which I believe both Justice Acoba and Justice Nakayama were in the decision of the court, defense counsel, like here, did nothing. All he did was exercise his preempts and pass the panel for cause. This counsel, understanding the purpose was to get an impartial jury, he passed for cause. He didn't ask for anything. He didn't object to any procedure. He went through the trial. Everything was copacetic, prevailed on some counts, didn't prevail on others. Then, at the conclusion of the trial after the verdict,
counsel, Iuli is different, though, isn't it? Because in Iuli, all this occurred before, this occurred before the perems were finished, were completed. Here, everything is finished, and then the request to exclude additional jurors is made.
No, it's not finished. This court's precedent in Jones, 45 Hawaii 247, said that sua sponte, the court can dismiss a juror for cause if the reason develops during the questioning of the juror. It's not finished.
Assuming that to be true, then, how do we reinstate, how would you reinstate the parity that is incorporated in the rule and in the statute that the prosecution and the defense should have the same number of peremptories? So in effect here, didn't the prosecution, by not exercising its peremptories on, 43 and 8, have an extra opportunity to exclude the same jurors by renewing its motion and having the court dismiss them after all the peremptories had been finished?
Absolutely not. Because when you renew the motion, is there a guarantee that it will be granted?
Okay, fine. If it were not granted, we wouldn't be here. But it was granted. That's why we're here. So that's why I asked that question.
And that's why I say absolutely not. And more so, because number two, if there was anything improper, defense counsel would have informed the court.
Defense counsel already used up all his correct.
That would be beside the point. The court has the inherent authority to award more preemptory challenges. State versus.
Then why didn't the court do it?
Because it wasn't asked. Because
the court has to be asked after it changes the procedure?
The court didn't change the procedure. Nobody has cited any rule that says you cannot bring a four-cause challenge after preempts. They can be brought any time throughout the trial. So there was no changing of the procedure. There just simply was not. In Carvalho and Timmons, it was clearly incorrect. I understand that. And that's because prior to the preempts, they weren't told the total number of alternates. You don't have that situation here. And you don't have a counsel saying that anything done was unfair, he was impaired, he was otherwise dissatisfied. So to
you
say.
Know, I think what Justice Duffy said is really a terrific summary of the purpose of peremptory challenges. The purpose of peremptory challenges to enable a party to sort of shape the jury insofar as it can, based on who the prospective jurors are. So if you exercise all your peremps and the jury panel changes, then how can you shape the jury or exercise your opportunity to shape the jury to the limited extent the law gives it if the jury panel changes after you used up all your peremptories?
Number one, that's not the purpose that this counsel said he was selecting a jury. He wasn't trying to shape anything. He said he was trying to select an impartial jury. Number two.
I think which is laudatory. I mean, I think that's great. I sort of have a problem with saying, you know, and the court say it too, that, you know, the purpose of a peremptory challenge is to choose an impartial jury. If a juror is not impartial, then the juror should have been excluded on a challenge for cause. And that's the purpose of a challenge for cause, to eliminate people who are not impartial. But even if people appear to be impartial, you may have the feeling that they may not be what they claim to be. And so the law gives the party a limited opportunity to exclude people without giving any reason for doing so. That's the purpose of a peremptory challenge.
That's actually
you don't have to give any reason to exercise a peremptory challenge.
That's not correct. State Legs versus
okay.
Legs in 71.
You don't have to give, let me just finish. You don't have to give any reason for exercising a peremptory challenge. You do have to give a reason for challenging for cause.
That's not true.
Okay, fine. That's the difference.
No, the difference is not that, because if you have a discriminatory practice of excusing all women,
that aside, we all know that.
No, we all don't know that. Because that is one
okay.
of the problems with the preempts.
Right.
It's not, this court has said.
Okay, going along
Supreme
with
court
the new Supreme Court has said.
It's not a freewheeling, no holds barred, you see.
You're
it's
only stating
not.
The obvious that we all
no,
know.
No, I don't.
Let Justice Acoba finish his questions before you respond.
Yeah, okay. You know, we acknowledge you cannot discriminate on the basis of race, gender, or sexual orientation when you pick a jury. That's fine. I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about, you know, matters that don't involve a constitutional right or constitutional protection. That's all I'm saying.
I agree. And that's why it will always be the case when defense counsel uses his last preempt to excuse that juror, and this new replacement sits, he will have no preempts. He will have no preempts. That's a fundamental part of this jury selection process, which is a result of Echenique, where they say we're not going to do the Schrock method, where we first will question the entire array for cause.
This is a point of interest.
Well, wait.
Counsel, have you ever reserved your last peremptory challenge when you tried cases?
I've ever reserved it.
Yes. Waived it, sorry. Your last peremptory challenge.
Yeah, just like Mr. Ching did in this case. He waived his alternate challenge.
Right.
So that what that shows is you don't, just because you have them doesn't necessarily mean you will use them. You use them to.
And so you agree you don't, you're not required to use all of them.
Naturally.
And then you don't hold that against the defendant, that he doesn't, that's not a requirement, that he has to use all of his peremptories in order to make a claim that there's a problem with the court denying a peremptory charge.
No, that's different, Your Honor. Illuli would
disagree with
say,
that.
Well, no, Illuli would definitely say that's a different situation. Because if you complain that a juror sat that shouldn't have been, that should have been excused for cause, and you don't use your peremptories, you wouldn't be able to say on appeal that your right to use the peremptories was denied or impaired. But what you would be able to challenge on appeal is your Sixth Amendment right to have a fair and impartial jury if you're, if you successfully challenge the denial for cause. So let's keep those separate. There's a specific reason why the court in Illuli and Cowie do those distinctions, where they want counsel to use their preempts, ask for a new one, and identify who they were struck. Because then you have a record from which the court could reasonably, legitimately, and genuinely conclude, yeah, his right to use his peremptories was denied or impaired.
But the U.S. Supreme Court said that in Ross, but they said that in terms of determining whether there was a constitutional due process violation for in terms of how state law said you could use your peremptories.
Exactly correct. So what they
so
did
that doesn't also, apply in this case.
No, Martinez does, which Illuli cited. They took up the question that was unanswered in Ross, where it's a denial or impairment, where counsel.
Have you read Martinez? Course,
have I read what?
Martinez.
Yes, Your Honor.
You know, in Martinez, it was a. Sorry, I keep asking questions, but in Martinez, it was
Don Gilbert.
Multi-defendant case, right?
Correct.
And under the federal statute, in multi-defendant cases, a defendant can ask for more peremptories than ordinarily given, correct? And so Illuli apparently picked that up and said, okay, you could have asked for more peremptories, but under our statute, even in multi-defendant cases, there is no allowance for additional peremptories.
That proposition is not entirely correct, because under this court's precedent, State versus Levinson, 71 Hawaii 492, this court has the inherent authority to provide process where none exists, which includes specifically in Levinson awarding additional preempts. So that is
and that
not
would be
correct.
The way that would be the way to cure this disparity in how many opportunities one side had with respect to the other in terms of the exercise of peremptories or excluding jurors from the panel.
That might be a cure in another case where defense counsel voices to the court his concern that there has been a disparity. But actually, see, that didn't happen in this case, which is why this case is like Illuli. You had a fully engaged counsel who knows what he's doing picking a jury and who has, for lack of any other information in the record, tactically chose to be satisfied. So what I am not prepared today and what I will not do today is concede that there was an error that defense counsel felt had impaired his right. These cases were in existence years before this trial happened. So to sit silent and do nothing and then think on appeal, notwithstanding this court's decision in PUAOI, which said we're not going to accept invited error, or HOANG, which said that we're not going to presume error on a silent record, to say nothing and now disingenuously come to this court and say, oh, the jury selection was really unfair. It was really, it should reverse. No, there's nothing here constitutionally that would allow this court to reach the conclusion genuinely that the juror that found this individual guilty was otherwise anything but fair and impartial. Now, we can talk in the abstract about what may have happened, what could have happened, but it should start, according to our precedent, with defense counsel notifying the court, I have a problem.
Mr. Fudo, at the risk of raising additional philosophical or ethical issues, let me just ask you a simple question. What is your understanding of the purpose of exercising a peremptory challenge?
To, in accordance with HRS section 635.27, I would have questioned that juror and determined he was either qualified or not. If he's not qualified, it was because he had a disqualifying interest or bias. That's what it would be. And I can't try and make some pretense because I know that if I get called to Thank you. And if I know if I get called to question as to why I exercise it, I have to be able to give the trial court a legitimate reason for exercising that preempt. So it can't just be, and defense counsel didn't just think, oh, I want to shape this jury so it'll be more conducive for me. Isn't that just fundamentally and philosophically at odds with a fair trial? Should it be fair to both sides, or should it be fair just to one side?
Isn't the matter of determining fairness for both sides a matter for the court when they decide whether a challenge for cause is to be granted or not? But isn't it also a fact that among trial lawyers, your duty is to your client to get rid of the potentially three worst jurors that are potentially going to serve on your jury? Don't you have a duty to your client?
Naturally, but we have a duty to the client to represent him within the bounds of the law. So if he's sitting there and saying, I raped a child, so I don't want any female on the jury, as counsel, what am I supposed to be? The Allen Court potted plant and say, okay, if that's what you want, that's what I do. No, I need to do it within the bounds of the law. And fundamentally, what you just said about challenging for cause, it starts with counsel asking the judge to rule on it. That's the whole give and take of trial. Litigants make requests to the courts. The court, especially in jury selection, it's on the fly, it's fast paced. So there will be consequences on appeal for decisions made. But it should always start with the court was given something to decide. Really, if you don't give the court the opportunity to decide, how do you fault the court? If the court has the inherent authority to award more additional preempts, who would best know I need them? The court or defense counsel? I believe it's defense counsel. I believe it's the prosecutor. You don't hear any intimation in this case anywhere that the prosecutor renewed the challenge for cause improperly or for an ill motive. And that should be significant to this court in light of its pronouncement in Mara, 98 Hawaii at 1, where the court looked at whether there was an improper motive or improper purpose with respect to the challenges. You just don't have that here.
Let me ask you this. In your years of practice, you're obviously younger than I am, Mr. Fudo, but in your years of trial practice, did you ever have a similar situation happen where the motion for a cause removal was made afterwards and there were no preempts?
No, I haven't. He said I was 85 years
old. I didn't. Thank
you. But I would say, though, is if I was placed in that situation and I believe that the process had been fundamentally unfair, I have a duty to my client to ask the court to consider giving me additional preempts. I have a duty to that client before I start the trial to be aware of the holding in State versus Levinson 71 Hawaii at 492, Iwahi, Kauhi, Kawamata, Iuli, to know that I can do it. And fundamentally, before I ever step through those doors and represent any counsel, I'm going to be charged with the responsibility as a professional in our noble profession to know the rules and to know the pertinent precedent as it pertains to my case. So in light of that, and there's no indication that Mr. Ching is anything but an eminently qualified attorney, you have to consider that he had no protest with the process. And there's no law that says a motion can't be renewed. Your precedent in State versus Cho, 115 Hawaii at 373, says the court has the inherent authority to at any time reconsider its interim rulings and interlocutory orders. The prosecutor renewed that motion and no one said, objection, improper, can't do that, entertained it. And then counsel participated in the question. Yes, Your Honor.
Mr. Fudo, if we could just come back to the plain error issue. I know Mr. Esser characterized that as the central issue as to whether we'll notice plain error or not. Now, in Timas and Carvalho, the ICA did notice plain error in those circumstances. And Mr. Esser's argument is we cited those cases approvingly in Iuli. Is this case factually distinguishable from Timas and Carvalho in your mind or not?
It's definitely factually distinguishable because in this case you don't have a clearly incorrect violation of the rule. You don't have anything. At most, what you might have is an irregularity, a situation that was not contemplated, and that's why I implore the court to read State versus Mara, 91 Hawaii at 1. It said when there's an irregularity, that doesn't warrant reversal when the jury that decided the case on the merits was impartial. The rules can't contemplate everything, and that's why the court is given the inherent discretion and broad discretion that is to control the conduct of voir dire. With respect to plain error, it's supposed to be sparingly used. Quote, it must turn on the facts of the particular case to correct errors that seriously affect the fairness, integrity, or public reputation of judicial proceedings. Let me ask this court to consider this. You would be thinking that if you were thinking to reverse, think of the unfairness and the perversity of justice that would occur. The jury that was fair enough to find him not guilty, okay, those verdicts stand. The same jury that found him guilty, those verdicts have to be retried. So what he does is get the benefit of doing nothing by not being allowed to be retried on the 8 acquittals. Having said nothing and never said it was unfair, he would get that benefit. I don't know, and I just, as a father with a daughter, I guess I'm emotionally invested in this case, and I can't see for the life of me anything in this record where a man on the street would say, yes, that's fair. And we would respect the court giving this individual a new trial on the four guilties, where he did nothing at trial to say that the trial was otherwise unfair, and vigorously defending his client to the extent that he had about 8 not guilties. The trial was fair. If there's an irregularity with the process, let the court handle it. The court can handle it simply. Ask the court. I've done very wild things in Supreme Court arguments. I've had a defendant arrested in the middle of the argument and taken away. How did that happen? Mr. Fudo, you can do things by motion. Defense counsel said his piece. I said, well, if that's the case, I believe as a matter of law, this court should have the defendant arrested right now and revoke the bail pending on appeal that I had contended was erroneously granted. What did the court do? Counsel approach. Hey, you guys stay here until the defendant stay here. Court goes out. About 40 minutes later, they come back in. Defense counsel, anything more? Nothing. Prosecutor, anything more? I just renew my motion. What happens? Sheriff, arrest that man. It's by motion. You come into court prepared, and there's a give and take, and it'll always go through the court, but the precedent is, make your record. Preserve your point. Or an appeal, don't be heard to complain. My time is up. Unless there's further questions. Thank you for your time.
Thank you very much, Mr. Fudo. Did Mr. Esser have time remaining or not? Mr. Esser, we had a series of questions right at the end of your time. Do you have any rebuttal at this point?
I have nothing to add. Thank
you very much, counsel, for both parties. The court will take this matter under advisement.
Please rise. This honorable Supreme Court of the State of Hawaii stands adjourned for further notice.